This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Jane Anne Gardia. As CEO of Virgin Money, she is arguably the most influential female banker in the UK and one of very few women in the top flight of finance, a situation she's working hard to change. A couple of years back, she led a government review into why the financial world seems so bereft of women in the boardroom. In her own small way, her mother was something of an equality pioneer. Back in Birmingham in the 1950s, she was one of the very first female bank tellers. My castaway, as an only child, says she was very tall, awkward, and bullied at school. As a grown-up, she's been frank about her struggle with postnatal depression. Reasons, perhaps, why she's a supporter of the mental health awareness charity Heads Together. She says, "Everything in my life has been an accident. And the only reason it happened is that I've always been excited to go through a door that hasn't been opened before. Taking opportunities has always been something I've loved and it hasn't let me down yet." So welcome, Jane Anne. As far as going through these doors that were never opened before, every successful career needs a bit of, you know, we can call it good luck, yeah, fate, whatever. What qualities, though, do you think you personally possess that have meant that the doors have managed to be opened by you in particular?
I think that I've always loved people and loved chatting to people. And so wherever I've been keen to meet new people, talk about what they do and understand more broadly how their lives are and how organisations work. Balance sheets and numbers are just the output, but it's the people that make the business serve the customer and do great things.
I mentioned in the introduction that the Treasury had asked you to conduct this review into women in finance. You'll know as well as I do, the FTSE Top 100 ranges across all sorts of industries, and yet there are still only, I think it's 7 currently, women CEOs in the FTSE 100 companies. It would seem that the problem is not just confined to banking. Why just stick to banking?
It's worse in banking than everywhere else. That was right. The thing that shocked me, and I felt ashamed by that. Why on earth would we have created a financial services industry that was more close to women than anywhere else? So we've come up with the Women in Finance Charter that the Treasury, HM Treasury, support and lead. And what that says is we want CEOs in financial services to properly put this issue on their agenda, set themselves targets and make sure they've got the right balance of men and women in their business. Now, of course, on the positive side, we're thrilled that more than half of the people that work in financial services now work for firms that have signed the charter. That means that half don't. And so companies have chosen not to sign the charter. And I'm afraid I'm now starting to say to women, if you work for one of those companies, find out why they haven't signed. Work out if you really like the culture or not. And if you don't, get out and join a company that's more progressive and is going to be more successful. And I think that, you know, as women, we have to take that really to those businesses and really make a difference.
Tell me about your first disc this morning then, Jane Anne Gardia. What are we going to hear?
Well, we're going to hear Pachelbel's Canon in D. Every time I hear it, I remember how it changed my life. I was in my late 20s, I should think, at the time, when I went on a course called the Leadership Challenge. And it was all about how leadership requires us to step out of our comfort zone. And at the very end of this 2-day course, we were all asked to watch a film and to listen to music and to create a vision of the future that this music brought to mind. And the music, of course, was Pachelbel's Canon in D. And as I told my story and gave a vision of what I thought the world could be like, I thought, gosh, never knew I had that vision in me. And I was given a cassette to play back in the car on the way home. And I think this music was something that lifted me and inspired me. And I feel that inspiration every time I hear it.
Thank you. That was part of Pachelbel's canon in D. And Jane Angardi, you said going into that that was chosen as music on a leadership course where you were encouraged to write and then to give a presentation explaining your view of what leadership meant. What was it you learned and what was it you said about the role of leadership?
Certainly that was the time that I realised that leadership for me, it's the art of helping people to get together to create something that you think should be done. And how do you get people together around a balance sheet? You can only get people together, I think, around a common purpose.
Your career is notable by being untouched by any sort of subprime horrors or by PPI scandals or by LIBOR. But I wonder, as a banker, if you must have felt in the last few years completely tarred by the same brush.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when people start to not want to join banking because of the lack of trust, and, you know, when we see in the women in finance work that women don't want to join because of the poor culture, I think we all feel tarred by that brush. And the point that I should make is that I know many, many, many bankers, and everyone wants to solve this problem. I think that the banking sector today is, from the inside, and I hope from the outside, transformed and unrecognisable from the system that it was before the financial crisis in 2008. And there's lots of technical reasons for that and regulatory reasons for that. Banks have more capital. The regulators absolutely focus on people's sort of fitness and properness for the jobs that they do. And I think that's exactly right. It's an overhead for banks, but I don't hear anybody saying that it shouldn't be done. So I do think that's important. But at the end of the day, it's people that will make the difference. And having good people that do the right thing for the right reasons, which for me means realising that banking is a service to our customers and our economy, primarily, and that profits come out of that, and that being driven by the profit motive purely is never, ever going to result in the best form of banking.
Time for some more music, Jane Angardia. Tell me about your second.
My second choice is a Queen track, and I've loved Queen for a very, very long time. Discovering Freddie Mercury and all the excitement that he brought to the stage was something that marked a transition for me between my childhood, I think, and my late teens. And I said, perhaps a bit stupidly recently, to one of the newspapers that I know all Queen tracks and can sing them, and somebody did ask me to sing it in public, which, of course, I shouldn't have done, but did. So I wasn't sure which Queen track to choose, but in the end I had to choose the one that I think properly transformed the world of music. And although it's a bit predictable, it's still absolutely magnificent, and that's Bohemian Rhapsody. Mama, life had just begun, but now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mama, didn't mean to make you cry. If I'm not back again this time tomorrow, carry on, carry on. Nothing really matters.
That was Bohemian Rhapsody from Queen and Jane Angardia. I will not ask you to sing from that.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit then about your childhood, and tell me about the stories where you would call yourself Jane Ann the Fighter and you would come out on top.
Oh, I'm an only child and definitely grew up in a sort of working class family that was trying to better itself. I was born in the 60s. Money was short and travel was non-existent, really. And I liked my books. And as I went to sleep, I would always imagine myself in some sort of difficult... I used to like Robin Hood, right? And I could imagine myself in the Sherwood Forest fighting off these baddies and being the person that was leading people. Those were childhood stories. But oddly, they've sort of stayed with me. And you do have to be very resilient, don't you, in the world and in the jobs that we do in order to take the knocks and sort of bounce back. And I think that when I need that resilience, some of these stories come back and remind me that actually, however tough things are, you can always find a way through.
I was going to ask you, you know, triumph over the baddies and all that, you know, who the baddies were. But I read an interview with you. You said you were properly duffed up by the boys at school.
Yeah, not actually physically, but I was in the first year of girls there, so it had been a boys' school forever. And from memory, there were about 17 of us. I suppose I would have been 14 or 15 when I went there, and I was over 6 foot tall. And, of course, boys aren't over 6 foot tall normally at the age of 14 or 15. Mm. And so from the moment that I arrived, I would be screamed at by these boys who'd hide behind corners and dash out at me screaming. You know, I was the freak show. And although that continued throughout my time there till I left in the sixth form, in the end, you know, I'd sort of won them over, I guess, and it was more in fun than it was in horror. Right. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I still remember my school days with a lot of warmth. The school was great, the teachers were good, and you know, I was blessed with a good education.
What did your parents say about all that happening?
Well, of course, I never told them, because from my parents' perspective, you know, me going to that school was a big deal. I'd got there on some sort of grant or scholarship, but I think they had to pay some money for me to be able to go. That was quite tough for them at that point. I think this is one of the things about bullying, really. It's sort of embarrassing to tell people that you're being bullied. And so,
because there's a shame in it.
There's definitely a shame in it. And so it wasn't anything that I was, as a young teenager, ready to talk about. I suspect it built an inner resilience that has served me well in the world of men subsequently.
Let's have some more music, Jane-Anne. Tell me about your third. What are we going to hear?
Well, we're going to hear Gary Moore and Parisian Walkways, because we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that as a child of the 60s, you didn't go away much. And I remember the first time I left the UK, I was 18. My parents took me and my best friend, Liz, to Paris for a weekend, and I can remember we got a hovercraft over, got on the train to the Gare du Nord, got out of the train, and I can smell now the Gauloises as you got out at the station and see the cafes down the road. And Paris felt like the most exotic place, was the most exotic place that I'd ever been.
I remember Paris in 49. Champs-Élysées, Saint-Michel, and old Beaujolais wine. And I recall that you were mine in those Parisian days.
That was Gary Moore and Parisian Walkways. Jane-Anne Gardier, these days students who leave school with good exam results and a guaranteed place at university, as you did when you were pretty young, a year early, I think, when you
got that
guaranteed place, they might these days go to, you know, South America or somewhere in Africa to volunteer. You went as far as the Unemployment Benefits Office in Diss in Norfolk.
I did, yes.
Why was that?
Well, when I left school, as I say, money was a bit tight at home, and my mum and dad were very keen that I'd get a job and start to contribute. And I remember my mum taking me to sign on at what used to be called the Dole office, and it didn't take very long for me to find actually a job there. And
this was sort of 1979. Unemployment was a very, very big issue. When you were there as a young woman, what did you notice? What were your thoughts?
It was the first time that I'd entered the real world and seen the challenges that people from all walks of life have to deal with. It was mainly men actually signing on, because of course mainly men were working at that particular point. And whether it was men that were devastated to have been made unemployed, younger people that were starting out, or people that have no fixed abode, NFAs, it was a hugely colourful and in-depth experience. And we were always told never to give the claimants, as they were referred to, money. And I bumped into a lad that I'd signed on. He was not much older than me, one lunchtime, and he said to me, "Love, can you lend me a fiver? I really need to have something to eat. I really fancy some fish and chips." And I thought, I'm being told I shouldn't do this, and I'll lose my job. But I just wanted to let him have the money, so I gave him the fiver and worried about it for ages. And a few weeks later, he came in. And, you know, when you're frightened, that sort of rush of adrenaline through your body. And I thought, oh, no, he's going to come and say what I'd done. And he said, "I just wanted a quiet word and to give you your fiver back." And I must have looked surprised. And he said, "Thank you so much for trusting people like me." And it was the best lesson. And I've never forgotten that.
And tell me this, when you're recruiting youngsters, are you looking for a good degree, good school exam results, or are you looking at the character?
Character first every time. And I do think that attitude and temperament are the absolute key. And I'm a mother of a nearly 15-year-old, and I hope she does okay in her exams. But it's not the be-all and end-all of everything. Never take no for an answer. Go and bang on the doors and tell people why you're brilliant. Don't be annoying about it, but just be confident about it, because people will listen.
Right, Jane Ann Gardia, let's go to the music. We're going to hear your fourth.
After I'd been working at the Unemployment Benefit Office, it became time for me to head off to university. So I went on what's called the Milk Round, where students go to see universities that they might like to go to. And I was in Bristol one night, and we went out to disco, and it was a smoke-filled room. It was dark and the music was loud, and on came Jerry Rafferty's Baker Street. I was really taken by this particular new life, and I knew that this was the beginning of something really special.
Winding your way down on Baker Street, light in your head and dead on your feet. Well, another crazy day, you'll drink the night away and forget about everything. This city desert makes you feel so cold. It's got so many people, but
that's Baker Street from Jerry Rafferty. Jane Ann Gardia, there is a particularly touching passage in your autobiography where you say, there are lots of things looking back that are hard to believe. Until I met Ash, I had never peeled a clove of garlic or tasted a mango. I had never contemplated a view of life different from my own. And I had certainly never come across the idea of arranged marriages. So tell me how you met.
Ended up going to London University, and I arrived on Freshers' Week and went on the first night down to the bar, and one of the guys came over, and that turned out to be Ash. But because, you know, in Indian men, he's the oldest son and was expected to have an arranged marriage, because of that, he would go and see people that his family thought would be good for him to marry, arranged wives, in other words. And so I was kept a big secret for quite a long time. So it was an interesting and colourful and new experience in so many ways. Now, he was...
Did you ever say to him, no, you're not?
No, I never, ever stopped him from going to see these sort of potential new wives. I think I was just always confident that nothing would come of it. But he was 2 years ahead of me at university. And so when he left, he actually went to live with my parents and got a job in East Anglia, but told his parents that he was staying with a friend and was working with this particular friend. Anyway, Dad was away 1 week working, and so I'd said to Ash, why don't you bring my mum down to university for the weekend? And when they got home, Mum and Dad's house had been burgled. And as it turned out, his mum rang just at that point, and without thinking, he said, oh, I can't talk to you now, we've been burgled. And his mum said, oh, I'm coming up to see you because all of your things must have gone. Anyway, as a consequence of all of that, of course, the truth came out. And his mum first said to him, well, you know, I don't think I ever want to see you again. And then an hour later ran back and said, of course I do, bring her down tomorrow. And Ash's parents had got all of the family together in a house in Southall. And he had two little cousins at the time who were about 2 and 5. And I remember saying to them, everybody seems quite happy about the fact that I'm here. And they said, you don't really understand the language. You don't know what they're saying. And I said, oh, well, Grandad seems quite happy. And he said, oh, one of these boys said, Grandad's blind. He doesn't know you're white. And it was quite funny, and I've always been welcomed with open arms.
You know, we don't really think that much about mixed-race relationships these days. You know, it's not unusual. In the 1980s, though, I mean, how were you treated as a couple?
I remember I was just finishing my degree, and I'd gone home to study for my finals, and I used to study in Norwich County, Norfolk County Library, and there would be a man that would wait for me afterwards and chase me down the street, and he'd shout after me because he knew that my boyfriend was Indian. After that experience, I mean, I remember going to what was then called Ernst & Whinney.
Now Ernst & Young.
Now EY, actually.
Oh, well,
even a further generation on. And, of course, completely changed, I should point out. You know, very diverse organisation now. But at the time, there was one guy there who was particularly racist and refused to sign my wedding card when Ash and I got married because I was marrying an Indian man. And I remember being thoroughly upset. I don't recall saying to him what I would certainly say to him today.
Right, Jane Ann Gardia, let's hear your next piece of music then. We're going to hear your fifth.
So when Ash and I met 37 years ago, there was one particular piece of music that we've always said is ours. And we don't play it ourselves at all, really. That'd be a bit cheesy. But whenever it comes on, we go, that's our song. And it's REO Speedwagon and Keep On Loving You.
Your tune, Jane Ann Gardia, that is REO Speedwagon and Keep On Loving You. I should let listeners know that after university you went on, you trained as an accountant, you worked your way up through, well, a number of banking positions. You've gone on record as saying that alpha male banking has landed us in a lot of trouble. So let's then go back to the causes of the big financial crisis. In 2008, just remind people, of course, RBS was eventually, it was bailed out by the government to the tune of £45 billion. You had left RBS for Virgin in, I think, 2007. But prior to that, you'd worked at RBS and you'd worked very closely with Fred Goodwin for a number of years. How would you describe the pervading culture within RBS in those years prior to the banking crisis?
I should be very honest that I enjoyed a lot of the work that I did at RBS and I met a lot of good people. So, you know, I want to put that on the record first because it certainly wasn't in any way obvious that this was a bad place. And by the by, not all of it is bad. So I think the real point is that when RBS bought the NatWest Bank, it was such a brilliant deal to have done. It made RBS this great bank in Scotland, one of the biggest banks, certainly in the country, and probably one of the biggest banks in the world. And as a result, I think the management team, Fred Goodwin in particular, were fated for that success. And what that did, I think, was to create a drive for more and more of that growth and that success and results. And in the end, that over-focus on the output at all times meant that the senior management there lost control both of the business itself and the culture that underpinned it. And that was devastating for everybody involved from the very top all the way through. And I think that in a very alpha male culture, and certainly we saw a bit of it, a lot of it maybe at RBS, it was an attitude of win-lose. You know, I am going to win, I am going to succeed at all costs. And I think that has been very damaging. And, you know, it's undoubtedly the case that the people at the top of the organisation were people that had very similar attributes and skills. There was no diversity, I think, of thought and challenge.
I'm happy to say that collateralised debt obligations and credit default swaps are not my territory here on Desert Island Discs. But, you know, looking at the industry more widely at that point and the pyramid upon which it was built, was there ever a time when you began to understand just how deep the problem was that you felt there is something rotten at the heart of the banking industry right now and I'm working in it?
Well, so I'd answer that in two ways. The reason I was at RBS at all was that we, Virgin Direct at the time, had partnered with RBS to create a business called the Virgin One Account. And Richard Branson sold the whole business to RBS in 2001. And when he sold it, he wrote me a note and said, if ever you want to come back because you hate corporate life, just give me a call. And in October 2006, enough was going on at RBS for my team to say to me, do you remember when Richard wrote you that letter? It's time to give him a call. And by the middle of 2007, a lot of us came back to Virgin Money.
I mean, could you see the train coming down the track towards RBS?
No, but you mentioned these complicated financial instruments. I was running the RBS retail mortgage book at that point in time. And it wasn't Fred Goodwin at all that asked me to do this, but one of his team asked me why we were not securitising subprime mortgages. And I remember myself and my finance director at the time, we didn't know what that was. And we felt stupid, right? And I promise you, Kirsty, we scratched our heads and said, well, how does that work then? But not because we could see the train coming down the track, but because we thought all these really clever people really knew what they were talking about and we didn't. And it made me think, if I don't understand anything, I'm not going to do it.
Definitely time for some music, Jane Ann Gardia. Tell me about your sixth.
Whilst I was at RBS, the team there created a sort of corporate track. And it reminds me of Scotland, and I love Scotland. And the track is called Now We Are Free, and it's from the soundtrack of the film Gladiator.
Now We Are Free from the soundtrack to the film Gladiator, composed by Klaus Badelt, Hans Zimmer and Lisa Gerrard, performed there by Lisa Gerrard with the Lyndhurst Orchestra, conducted by Gavin Greenaway. Jane Ann Gardia, your daughter now, Amy, she's about 15 now,
I She'll think. Be 15 in August, that's right.
What does she make of her mother's extraordinary high-flying career?
somebody once said to me, does your daughter see you as a role model? I said, she's 14, she sees me as an embarrassment.
Amy came along after several miscarriages. You'd had 5 IVF attempts. You had eventually become pregnant around about the age of 40, and that must have been, apart from being thrilling to get the news, also given what you'd been through, it must have been a terrifying time as well? A nerve-wracking time?
I think, yes, because, I think I'd had about 9 miscarriages, and so...
Goodness me.
As it turned out, Amy, as she knows, may have been a twin, and we lost one of the two, and she, therefore, is a little miracle.
After she was safely delivered, you have written about, these are your words, you said you felt hopeless, miserable and out of control. And there'll be very, very many women who recognise that. Yes. That feeling of, you're building up to the moment that is going to make you the happiest in your life. And what happens is postnatal depression sets upon you. As somebody who was so used to being, efficient and strategic and coping, how did you deal with postnatal depression?
I think I tried to deny it for quite some time. So I was completely stupid. I thought that, I was so in control of my life that I'd be able to add a baby to it. And, of course, within a few hours of her being delivered, I realised that, of course, was not going to be in any way feasible. And, indeed, neither did I want it to be. I'd suddenly fallen in love with this little thing in a way I'd never thought possible. Ash had given up his job in order to look after her and me, because I was the main breadwinner. And so I felt completely trapped. It felt like, having read the Harry Potter books, the Dementors had come into the room for me. It felt like a black cloud was over me and my soul was being sucked out. And I had never experienced anything like it. I couldn't listen to music, which was definitely a sign of my depression. And I couldn't be at home anymore. And so we'd take ourselves off to a variety of friends or my mum's. I remember coming down to a hotel in London, which was the last straw. And I think that must have been a sort of acknowledgement that things were different and that we had to make a real decision to change things. And so I decided the way I'm going to cope with this is I'm going to work 9 till 6 and I'm only going to work 5 days a week and I'm not going to stay away from home at night. And at the end of that year, Norman, my boss, told me I'd had my best ever year. And I said, that's ridiculous. How can that be? I've struggled with being a mum and all of this illness. And he said, do you know what, Jane Ann? Having something in your life that's more important than work has made your judgment much better. You've had a brilliant year.
Jane Ann Gardia, let's have some more music. We're going to listen to your 7th now.
Well, from a child, as an only child, I definitely had a very intense relationship with the biggest pop star of the time, and that was Donny Osmond. And when I told one or two of my friends that I was going to have the privilege of being on Desert Island Discs, they all said, well, we'll know that Donny Osmond's going to be one of the tracks. And I said, no, not at all. I can't put any of that sort of music on. To which one of my friends said, that would be the act of the utmost treachery. And I thought, you know what? He's absolutely right. And so here's Donny Osmond with Survivor.
Now, as the seasons pass, I try to make it last, and I watched it fall away. But a man can't be measured by the number of times he's knocked down. It's all about what he does when he gets back up again. I'm a survivor. What you gonna change your mind for? You're the one I die for.
Your teenage heartthrob, indeed. Maybe your enduring heartthrob. That was Donny Osmond there with Survivor at Jane and Guardia. The financial services industry, a big part of it is encouraging us to think about our future. Are you somebody who thinks about their life in that way, who thinks, I've got an end game, I'm going to stop now, you know, there's the pot of honey?
Oh, that's quite difficult, isn't it? Because, of course, that's the right way to think about it. But my life has definitely been a succession of happenstance that has led me to different places, and I expect that to continue. I hope that I'm not going to retire, you know, I'm going to continue doing something, whatever it is. When people are fed up with me in banking, I hope that there'll be somewhere else to go and something else to do.
Let's hear your final disc. What is it, Jane and Guardia?
Throughout all of my years at Virgin Money, I've met some absolutely brilliant people. And of course, along the way, we've lost some of them. And we had a fantastic guy called Mark Barnes, who was our HR director for a number of years. And he very tragically died in a car accident at the age of 36. And the reason that I've picked this song is that it was played at Mark's funeral. And of course, every time I hear it, I think of him and everything that he brought to all of us, customers and staff and his team and to his family. So this is Bryan Adams, and Everything I Do It For You.
That was Bryan Adams, and Everything I Do It For You. I'm going to give you the books now, Jane Anne. You get the Bible, and you
Thank
get
you.
The complete works of Shakespeare. You're welcome. And you get to take one other book. What's your book going to be?
Well, the book that I know I'd love to read is Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, because we love the musical as a family.
Okay.
And then perhaps when I get off the island, I can know whether or not that musical is really true to it.
Ever the optimist, eh? You may have the book. Your luxury?
So my luxury item is a sari. A very colourful sari that would make me cheerful. I'd probably use it as a hammock if it was strong enough.
Right.
I might be able to use it as a flag to bring in my rescuers, and it would always make me think of India, its colour, and how much I love my husband and my family.
Wonderful. A sari is yours then. The one disc that you would save, if you had to, which one would it be?
It would have to be the Pachelbel, because it's the one of them all that makes me know that the world is good, we can make a difference, and our spirits can soar.
It's yours. Jane and Guardia, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website,
bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.